listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our show today, we'll spend the hour with two authors. First, Angie Schmidt, a renowned national expert on sustainable transportation in the U.S., joins us to discuss her book, Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Then we'll examine in detail the history and tactics of extremist right-wing armed groups in a new book by Arlie Perliger. It's called American Zealots, Inside Right-Wing Domestic Terrorism. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There is a little-known epidemic in the United States that is killing increasing numbers of people each year. It's little known because the victims are disproportionately poor and non-white. Pedestrian deaths have been rising in the U.S. steadily, while driver and passenger deaths have remained largely unchanged. In a new book examining this grim trend, the policies that drive it and what can be done about it, is my guest, Angie Schmidt, a renowned national expert on sustainable transportation in the U.S. She was a longtime national editor at Streets Blog, covering the movement for safe multimodal cities. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and more. And she now joins me to discuss her new book, Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Welcome to the program, Angie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I have to confess, when I saw your book, I was surprised. It was not something that I had heard about, thought about, or even expected. Tell me how much pedestrian deaths have increased over several years. What are the kind of numbers that we are seeing in the United States?
Right. So there's been about a 50% increase in pedestrian deaths over the last, roughly the last decade.
50%?
Yes, that's wow. Right. And at last count, there were more than 6,400 a year.
So 50% over a decade, and we're talking about upwards of 6,000 people a year. And of course, this is something that we're not seeing very much about. I imagine that a big part of it has to do with who its victims are. Who are the victims? What does statistics and record keeping show about who is basically dying from being hit by cars in American cities?
Right. Yeah. This problem is a little bit like Corona, where you would think, you know, not knowing much about it, that everyone would be impacted sort of equally. But when you dig into the data, a lot of this inequality that's a part of our society, a lot of the systemic racism starts to sort of come through. So Hispanic folks are at increased risk. They're about 1.4 times more likely to be killed. Black folks are even at higher risk. And the group that's most affected, Native folks, are 4.5 times more likely to be killed than the average person in the United States while walking.
Why is this happening? What has changed in a decade? If passenger and driver deaths have remained largely unchanged, but pedestrian deaths have increased, I mean, you know, is it that people are driving more recklessly? What has happened to cause this dramatic shift?
Yeah, so there's actually a few things going on, I think. So one of them is that the American population is aging, and older folks have always been at increased risk to be killed while walking for a number of reasons. Some of them are fairly obvious. So number two, we have some demographic changes taking place in the United States. We have a growth of poverty in the suburbs. You know, that phenomenon is known as suburbanization of poverty. So that means more folks are out walking in suburban locations that really weren't designed with pedestrians in mind. Thirdly, we have a lot of population growth in the Sun Belt region of the United States, and that traditionally has been the most dangerous area for pedestrians. And then finally, and this most important, so we have these demographic changes that are putting more people sort of in harm's way in risky positions, and they may be more vulnerable because of their age in the first place. But in addition, we've had a big change in our vehicle mix in the United States. Over the last 10 years, there's been an enormous increase in SUVs. We've seen sedans go out of style and start to disappear from some of the big automakers' even portfolios. So we have this big increase in bigger vehicles, and SUVs and big pickup trucks, they hit pedestrians higher on the body and with greater force. And there's some pretty strong data, including from the Federal Highway Administration, that shows pedestrians struck by SUVs are 2.5 to 3 times more likely to be killed than if they're struck by a sedan.
Let's go through some of these issues in a little bit more detail. The design of cities and how streets are built and designed, where grocery stores are placed with respect to neighborhoods. How do you analyze the role of such things? Particularly, I imagine, in lower income neighborhoods, you might find more people walking to the grocery store or back and forth, and maybe having to cross, you know, multi-lane streets and being more vulnerable to being hit?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So the most dangerous kind of roads are called suburban arterial roads. And those are roads, it's just a term for, like you said, multi-lane, high-speed roads. And they're especially dangerous when they have a mix of retail and residential, especially residential that is serving lower-income folks. So pretty much anytime you have a street like that with fast food or with retail, be it a big box store, you're going to have people needing to access it on foot. And there's been some research that's shown like that for every Walmart, for example, that's added in a low-income neighborhood, they can predict there's a measurable increase in pedestrian crashes for
wow.
every location.
Wow, that's incredible. So you know, we don't really think, I imagine city planners do, but the average American doesn't think about a big box store opening and its relation to the neighborhood in which it opens, the design of the streets and the placement of homes in relation to stores that attract shoppers, but of course that has a big role to play. I mean, is it just a matter of putting walkways in the right places?
I think that would be a good start. Yeah, I think that's just been sort of an afterthought. And one of the reasons I think people don't think about this that much is because so many of us that are in positions of influence, like in the media or in government, just aren't put in that position where we're relying on the bus to get to a low-income job at a Walmart, for example, and have to cross a very busy road, maybe at night. So I think that's one of the reasons it's been sort of like an invisible topic. But yeah, I mean, the people who do have to walk to a Walmart, for example, they have to navigate usually a very large parking lot that has no real safe access for pedestrians. And, you know, the placement of the bus stops, the street lighting, there's all kinds of factors that can influence their safety that often aren't even considered.
So you have the issue of design. There's parking lots. There are walkways. What about just simple warning signs? I mean, this is something that's incumbent on cities. We do see that if there's enough noise made by neighbors in a particular neighborhood about safety issues, usually people have to get together to petition cities who will maybe put a speed bump in or who will put signs in. How does that work? Is it something that cities in general just wait for people to die and residents to get angry and organize before putting in safety measures?
Yeah, that is usually the way it works. And unfortunately, a lot of times, even if they are organized, city staff is not very helpful. The engineering, the traffic engineering profession, I write a lot about in my book. It's really, there's sort of an ideology that's been the basis for traffic engineering, and it goes back to sort of the highway era in the United States. And the real focus there has been moving cars quickly. That's sort of been the sole focus of transportation planning in the United States for a long time, reducing delay for drivers. So engineers use rule books that tell them how to design roads, and a lot of the rules are actually biased against pedestrians. Like for example, one that I cite in the book is there's something called a warrant. So before transportation engineers can add a signalized crosswalk, so with a traffic signal, there have to be a number of people hit and killed in that location in a year. I believe it's five pedestrians hit, not all killed, I'm sorry, five pedestrians hit in a location in a year, or 93 pedestrians per hour have to be crossing in order for the engineering manual to say a traffic signal and a crosswalk is warranted.
Wow. So we are basically relying on drivers effectively avoiding pedestrians to ensure pedestrians are safe, rather than designing streets with pedestrian safety in mind.
Right, yes.
Incredible. There is the issue of the kind of vehicles that Americans like to purchase. You call them killer cars. Let's talk about killer cars. There's so much that is folded into this. Generally, when we talk about the rise in SUV sales in the U.S., it's with respect to fuel use of the oil and gas industry, pushing for the gas-guzzling SUVs. But how dangerous are these cars to pedestrians? Often people buy them, not because, of course, they want to spend more money on gas, but because they think that SUVs are safer for their families. I can't tell you how many friends I have who have upgraded from sedans to SUVs once they had a child, thinking that that SUV was going to keep their child safer. What's the problem there?
Right, yeah. So even the question of whether SUVs are safer than sedans, it's really not straightforward. And the idea that a bigger car is safer is not necessarily true, even for passengers and drivers. But we know very clearly that bigger cars, SUVs, pickups, very large pickups, are much more dangerous, particularly for child pedestrians. There may be a lot of visibility issues near the front and the back of some of these larger vehicles. Like some studies have shown, there's like a 10-foot blind spot in front of some of these bigger vehicles, like a Cadillac Escalade, where a child would be totally invisible until they're standing 10 feet away from the front bumper. So it's pretty bad. And in the United States, we have a lot of vehicle regulations. We require things in vehicles like airbags, anti-lock brakes, a lot of things. There's like hundreds of pages of regulations, but they only apply to, so far we've only used them to protect drivers and passengers. We've never imposed regulations on vehicle makers specifically to protect pedestrians.
So who is benefiting from this? Is it SUV makers? I mean, is it just sort of really effective public relations and advertising that that convinces Americans SUVs are the way to go, and it just tends to be more profit-making for car manufacturers and, of course, the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, yeah, sort of. It's sad, but... So it has been very, very profitable, the move from sedans to SUVs. And also some of these very large pickup trucks are very, very profitable for automakers. And it's disproportionately benefited American automakers who have been traditionally more invested in trucks and SUVs than foreign automakers. So that makes it a political challenge to address for lawmakers, because, you know, the American auto industry is located in sort of the Rust Belt region and supports a lot of good paying jobs. But, and again, going back to profit, these vehicles are very profitable for the automakers. The numbers I've seen for one of the, this is one of the top selling vehicles in the United States, this Chevy Silverado, that the maker, Chevy, makes $17,000 in profit per vehicle sold. So enormously profitable for those guys. And SUVs are similar. SUVs and crossover SUVs, they tend to cost about the same to construct and make as a sedan, but they typically cost $10,000 to $15,000 more. So they're $10,000 to $15,000 more profitable for automakers to sell. And so a lot of the advertising, and automakers are enormous advertisers. They spend more than $30 billion a year advertising, and that really influences people, and it definitely is part of the reason.
Are there statistics showing that SUV incidents or accidents, if you will, are more fatal than sedan accidents? I mean, I imagine that when you're hit by a sedan, you might be more likely to live because, well, your whole body might not be crushed.
Yes. The Federal Highway Administration, they did a literature review in 2015, and they found pedestrians hit by an SUV are 2.5 to 3 times more likely to be killed than those who are hit by a sedan. And there's some other research that shows, so we've seen about a 50% increase in pedestrian deaths, like I noted. But even if you hold traffic crashes or pedestrian car crashes steady for the last 10 years, they have, there's been a 80% increase. So what I'm trying to say is 30% of the increase is just more severity, not an increase in crashes overall. So that could be a couple of things, but one of the clearest sort of rationale is that vehicles are getting bigger and heavier.
Another trend, of course, in the United States over the past decade, which I'm wondering plays any role in the rise in pedestrian deaths, is cell phone use. People have, more people have cell phones now than ever before, and it's deeply tempting to, check your Facebook, posts while you're driving. Are we seeing more distracted driving because there's just so much cell phone use?
So we don't, it's a little bit difficult to tie that to car crashes just because most people aren't very forthcoming about it if they were distracted before a crash. And usually our crash investigations aren't very thorough. But we do know that people who have smartphones use them all the time, like use them on almost every trip and are distracted by them for a significant amount of time on most of their trips. And we also know that is really, really dangerous. It's like, it's a lot like drunk driving, distracting on the danger level, but it hasn't been sort of stigmatized the same way.
So here we have thousands and thousands of pedestrian deaths per year. The number is rising. What are, you know, is this trend being noticed by authorities who can actually do something about it? Or I should maybe first ask you, what would you say to city authorities and planners and policymakers? Because if we know the trends that are linked to rising pedestrian deaths, we can clearly, obviously, do something about them.
Yeah, so a lot of cities really have been trying to tackle this. They've been adopting, they call it Vision Zero plans. So Vision Zero is this idea that was imported from Sweden. And it's the idea is that no amount of traffic deaths should be considered acceptable. In the United States, our policy has always been, well, how many traffic deaths did we have last year? Let's try to do a little bit better. So this is a big sort of paradigm shift. And a lot of cities like New York is one of the leaders, San Francisco, New York is redesigning, like they're retiming their traffic signals. So pedestrians have a little head start on traffic. They may be redesigning roads and adding bike lanes and that type of thing. So there's a lot of tools. Cities are really important, and road designers play a really important role in addressing the problem. In addition, I think there's a lot of room for progress on vehicle regulation. Like I mentioned, we have some semi-autonomous safety features that are starting to come standard in some luxury vehicles, like automatic emergency braking or pedestrian detection, that have been shown sometimes to have a big impact. But so far, the federal government has held off on requiring any vehicle regulations that would protect pedestrians.
If this is an issue that has policy solutions, why do you think people are holding back, cities and authorities are holding back from addressing it?
So some of it is inertia, you know, that our sort of systems, our infrastructure systems are still sort of set up from the highway era, and there hasn't been a fast enough and a big enough change. I also think the demographics of the people being killed, a lot of times people who are most affected haven't really been empowered to speak up, or aren't able to influence the political system the way better off folks are that may have more of a self-interest in fast car commutes.
So in your book, you have many stories of individual lives lost, so many tragic stories. And I imagine that is, of course, done so that people can see the human cost of this unaddressed problem. How important is it to share these stories to a wider audience? Because it's easy to look at these individual deaths as tragedies, but not necessarily see them systemically as a whole, as a problem that has systematic reasons behind it. I mean, we look at, you know, every time there's a mass shooting in the US, we have a conversation about guns and about the availability of guns. But when somebody gets killed, a pedestrian gets killed on a street, it doesn't generate conversations about geography and city design and SUV use.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The media has traditionally not done a great job with this issue, or although it's getting better. Typically, if a pedestrian is killed, there might be one or two paragraphs in the newspaper, and it'll be really impersonal, and they might have the effect of sort of blaming the victim. So they might like imply the victim was at fault, and that's sort of it, right? We don't hear much more. We don't get like with the opioid epidemic, we started to see, you know, really sympathetic profiles of the people who are being affected. And I think we need that kind of coverage on this issue in order to move forward. But it's seen as so sort of routine and unsexy. And so people, all these people who are impacted by this problem, not just pedestrian deaths, but car crashes in general, just sort of suffers silently, and it becomes like a very private issue, even though it's affecting thousands of people every year.
And this shouldn't this also be seen as part of the systemic racism that we have built into American cities? I mean, there are so many inequities built into our, say, systems of education, our criminal justice system, and also when it comes to traffic safety issues.
Yeah, the same sort of thing. I think, you know, inequality, economic inequality and racial injustice is such a huge part of our culture that it sort of shows up in a lot of places you wouldn't expect it. But yeah, absolutely. Neighborhoods of color are being passed over for sort of the safety treatments they need. And there's a really smart guy, Charles Brown, who wrote a foreword to my book, who's a researcher who studies this stuff. And he says Black and brown neighborhoods, they, when they have a safety problem, they get enforcement. So they get police coming to their neighborhood and ticketing them for jaywalking. And a lot of times that can be really harmful and explosive.
And can result in more deaths. Instead of being hit by a car, they could be killed by a cop.
Yeah, absolutely. Or beaten up. Yeah. Or fines. And out of the fine, it leads to this sort of a cascading sort of legal troubles. But then in white neighborhoods, when they complain, they're much more able to secure sort of the safety elements that they really need.
Are there nations that can offer a model for the U.S. to address rising pedestrian deaths? Are there places in the world where better city design, better policies on vehicle standards offer a model?
Yeah, so Western Europe is sort of the leader, Western Europe and Japan, on road safety. And some of the best performers, like Sweden and Norway, have per capita traffic fatality rates that are a quarter or a fifth as high as the United States. So if we could do as well as Sweden, for example, we could save like 30,000 lives every year in the United States on traffic safety. But even the United States is even underperforms compared to more similar nations like Canada. Canada actually has a per capita traffic fatality rate that's half of the United States. So if we could do as well as Canada, we could save 20,000 lives a year.
20,000 lives a year? I mean, that's just shocking when we think of, you know, the fact that it's many of these are preventable deaths. Are there cities in the United States that are starting to tackle this issue better than others? Are there models within the United States that are showing the right way?
Yeah, some of the success stories I point to in the book, one of them is New York City. There's been a really energetic movement for safer streets there. Only about half of New Yorkers have a personal vehicle in the household. So they were making a lot of progress. And in 2018, they had the lowest number of traffic deaths in 100 years, basically since the since cars came into the city. It was like a really like an all-time low, and it has gone up since then. But another city I like to use as a positive example is Detroit. Detroit's made some big improvements, and one of the big things they did there was just make sure all their streetlights were working. That sort of in itself helped produce
Something as simple as that.
Yeah, helped produce a pretty dramatic decrease in pedestrian deaths, because about 75% of pedestrian deaths happen at night. So that issue of lighting is really important.
And also, I'm wondering if, you know, as we move into an era, hopefully, where we start to address climate change, our reliance on cars, at least it's the hope, will start to decrease. We saw during the pandemic, for example, when there were far fewer people on the roads, our air cleared up, there were more people walking. You know, we do want a future where there are more pedestrians and fewer cars. And that too plays into this this conversation around pedestrian safety, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really difficult challenge.
But and I should say more bikers as well. We didn't even get to talk about bikers, bicyclists.
Yeah, so some of the modeling I've seen about what we need to do to reach our climate goals shows that we need to electrify our vehicle fleet, for one, but also we need to reduce the number of car trips we're taking by about 20%. So about 1 in 5 trips needs to be either eliminated or replaced with a sustainable mode. So that is a really, really heavy lift. And there's only a few cities in the United States that have managed to reduce car trips over the last several years.
So finally, I'm wondering if you think that this book can also empower individuals to pressure their city authorities, because unfortunately, change does come from the, I shouldn't say unfortunately, in general, change comes from the bottom up. So I imagine that you're hoping that your book will be a tool for individuals, particularly those living in neighborhoods that have seen pedestrian deaths, just be this tragic aspect of their community. Maybe they've lost a family member to a pedestrian accident?
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to sort of raise the level of the discourse on it, trying to raise the issue more generally, yes, and absolutely. Some of the people who have taken this on are the people I highlight in my book are real heroes. I think it's a really difficult issue to take on, but we'll never make any progress without a lot of people caring. Yeah.
Angie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Wish you the best of luck with your book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Angie Schmidt, renowned national expert on sustainable transportation in the United States. She was a longtime national editor at Streets Blog, covering the movement for safe multimodal cities. Her writing has also appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and more. And we've been talking about her new book, Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Right-wing extremists in the United States have always wrought hatred and violence, but rarely been targeted by government surveillance or the disproportionate media coverage reserved for terrorists of the non-white, non-Christian persuasion. But during Donald Trump's presidency, the resurgence of armed right-wing violence and extremism is fueling fears of a new civil war. Tracing the historical roots of the myriad movements that have terrorized Americans and analyzing their tactics in a new book is my guest, Ari Perlinger. He's a professor and director of the graduate program in security studies at the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at University of Massachusetts Lowell. His many publications on political violence include Jewish Terrorism in Israel. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, American Zealots: Inside Right-Wing Domestic Terrorism. Welcome to the program, Ari.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Now, you began your research well before the rise of the political Donald Trump. And I imagine that you might, with dismay perhaps, see that your book has become so much more relevant than perhaps you might have foreseen. It seems as though, from reading your book, the landscape is actually more complicated than we think. There's so many different threads of different groups. There are many of them are localized. Some of them are more national. They're regional. There's history. And you spend almost a good half of your book on the history. I think most of us would identify the KKK as being one of the main historical origins of racist, armed, right-wing violence in the U.S., right? How do you place the KKK in the history of American right-wing domestic terrorism?
So You are correct. Really, one of the things that I'm really trying to do is to provide a broad historical overview of the evolution of the American far right throughout the years. And it was really important for me to convey to the reader the fact that there's really significant ideological differences between the different components of them, of the violent American far right. When we're talking about the KKK, we're talking about one component of a violent far right in the United States, components that usually includes the more traditional white supremacy groups, the KKK, its various branches, some of the more traditional neo-Nazi organizations, as well as some skinheads organizations that are still very active here in the US. But besides these groups, we also have the emergence of the militia movement for the last 20, 30 years. We have a significant presence of far-right militias in the 90s. Their activity declined in the previous decade, but in the last few years, we see really the re-emergence of the militia movements with some very active organizations such as the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters that basically are we can describe them as a very anti-governmental organizations that really see the federal government as a substantial threat to the freedoms of Americans. And finally, we also have a stream of a fundamentalist far right. These are organizations and groups that are using a religious text to justify white supremacy ideas, to justify a racial segregation, to justify a homophobic sentiments and anti-minority sentiments. So we really have a very complex and fragmented landscape when we are talking about the American far right.
Would you agree that some of the common threads to these myriad groups is whiteness and white supremacy, Christianity, and the sort of toxic patriarchal movements that feel as though they're under threat because women are now speaking out and have positions of power, non-cisgendered people are becoming more visible. So these sort of broad strokes, and then of course there's also the gun rights issue, these sort of broad strokes, commonalities, would you say that those are fairly strong threads through all of these movements?
Definitely. So we see when you're looking at the rhetoric of many of these movements, especially the contemporary discourse of these groups, we can see that there's a lot of emphasis on promoting misogynist, anti-feminist ideas and a concept. Many of these groups are talking about oppression of the white male. And they see that as a byproduct of globalization, of progressive ideas, and so on and so forth. So if I'm trying to clarify that, basically they are interested in preserving what they see as the natural privileges of the white people, and especially white males. And I think one of the interesting developments is that many of these groups believe that by embracing these misogynist, anti-feminist idea, they'll be able to better recruit new members. They believe that these kind of ideas are very attractive to a lot of young white males in America. So we see them basically talking a lot about emphasizing this idea of male supremacy as a tool to enhance their recruitment efforts. And naturally, many of them are really talking very clearly about the need to restore what they believe are the privileges and the superior status of the white race. And because of that, they also oppose open immigration policies. And in general, they oppose what they see as the growing powers of the central government that try to enforce cultural changes, social changes, demographic changes. So for them, it's one, you know, it's really it's a very comprehensive policy that's supposed to undermine their status and their privileges, and they believe that they should fight against that, against these kind of developments.
So very recently, we've seen some very serious violence from these right-wing armed groups who have become more visible. They're more bold about showing up with weapons. They are often tolerated, if not welcomed, by police. They've actually killed people in American cities. But if you look broadly speaking, how prevalent, how serious a problem in America is armed right-wing extremist violence? Because often it just hasn't received the media attention it should have received, you know, at least since before the Trump administration. It's often been pushed under the rug. And I know in your book, you've really tabulated and statistically looked at the history, across history, just how many attacks, how much violence they're responsible for.
So I think one of the interesting things is that when I started to study the American far right around 2011, 2012, most people looked at me as someone who is dealing with something which is very marginal, very insignificant. But what I felt is that, especially after the election of our first African-American president, I felt that there's really a significant increase in the activity of these far-right groups, especially the white supremacy groups, many of the skinhead groups. So I felt that it's really important to study and really to try to collect actual data that will enable us to understand these dynamics. And what we see is really since 2008, there's a consistent increase in the level of violence from the far-right, especially during the Obama years, but still today. And moreover, what we see is that as we're getting closer to presidential elections, usually we see increase in the level of violence, the environment become more contentious. Many members of these groups see this kind of electoral competition as a zero-sum game that they must win. So we really see increase in their activities, and this is something that needs to concern us, considering that we are getting very close to elections this year. So I have all expectation to see a continuous increase in the level of violence.
Do the incidents of violence from these groups, how do they compare with the kind of terrorists Americans often picture when they hear that word, right? We have been trained to think of terrorist attacks as coming from typically a Muslim or Arab man, you know, basically a non-white, non-Christian male. But do the incidents of violence by right-wing armed white vigilantes and armed groups, does it outweigh the violence that we've seen from some of these other non-white, non-American individuals?
Definitely. If you're looking at especially the last decade, we see that both in terms of volumes as well as in terms of number of casualties, the far right is responsible for a higher numbers of attacks as well as higher number of casualties. And by the way, this active something which was part of Americans' perceptions for a long time until the last decade or so. Most Americans, when they were thinking about terrorism, they were thinking about a foreign policy problem. The perceptions of many Americans was that when we're talking about terrorism, we're talking about that happens in other countries, that terrorism is usually happens in other countries or being perpetrated by foreign organizations. Violent acts by political groups from the far right usually were considered some kind of a hate crimes, or we use different designations. We are much more reluctant to categorize these acts as terrorism, something that really changed in the last few years as more and more academics as well as policy people acknowledge the fact that what we see is truly domestic terrorism. And many of these groups, their activity, their violence really fit our common definitions of terrorism, in the sense that they want to promote political goals, they want to use violence in order to terrorize the public, and so on and so forth. So I think this is one of the most significant changes that we've seen, both within the American public, but also within our government, the more willingness to understand that this is a significant threat that truly may undermine American democracy, can undermine the trust that people have in their governments, as well as the trust and the stability of our democracy. And if you ask me, I'm much more concerned about terrorism that is really is originating from within, from our society, than something which is coming from other places, because, you know, this is really something that is violence that is perpetrated by Americans against Americans. And these kind of internal conflicts really have the potential to destabilize our political system, erode the trust that people have in the democratic system, and eventually really create more divisions and more significant polarization.
Since in the years since the September 11th attacks, our government has spent so much money, so much time, so much effort in, you know, just setting aside the wars that we fought outside of the U.S., but the amount of money into surveillance, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security to, you know, ensure that terrorists don't destroy the country or perpetrate attacks. How much surveillance, how seriously has the U.S. government taken armed right-wing white vigilantes? You know, even historically, we've seen the U.S. government, the FBI, surveil and target Black civil rights organizations or Black power groups, the Black Panther Party. Have they done that same sort of thing to groups like the KKK? Have they infiltrated and surveilled the domestic terrorist groups that are armed, white, vigilante, Christian, male-dominated with the same enthusiasm?
So, naturally, Americans, especially on U.S. soil, have protections, constitutional protections, than foreign terrorist organizations or a foreign activists of terrorist organizations. So, naturally, are more limited in terms of the means that they can use in order to fight domestic terrorism. In this context, you really see a growing, more and more voices arguing that we need to develop a legal mechanism that will allow us to really designate these domestic groups as terrorist organizations, so we can use our anti-terrorism legislation against these groups. I think I'm a bit more skeptic about this legal mechanism. I think, especially in the American context, designating a specific organization as a terrorist organization, I'm not sure how helpful it will be, because these organizations are very dynamic, very fluid. They change their name, they change their structure very quickly many times. They split and merge, so it's much more difficult to use legal mechanisms against them. What we do need to do, however, is really to understand how they are able to utilize contemporary technology to radicalize young people, to radicalize youth, how they can really tap into the emotions and the attitudes of young people in the U.S. and are able basically to bring them to the fold of their very toxic and extremist ideology. So we really need to understand the processes that lead to the radicalizations of young people into these groups, and how we can create an environment that will be less conducive to this kind of radicalization, and especially in specific parts of the country. And I think that a part of it is finding ways to also reduce the growing political polarization that exists in this country, especially in the political arena. And the fact that so many Americans completely delegitimize the other political side, or are not willing to engage in any kind of discourse with the rival political, creates a breeding ground to the emergence of very radical, very militant groups. So it's really a much more broader process that needs to be implemented, that hopefully will make it more difficult for these groups to operate, to engage in illegal and violent activities, and to recruit new members. There's no other way but to think in long terms of how we can create really a social mechanism that will reduce the racial and political tensions in the country, and will enable us to engage in much more effective discourse to bridge these political gaps. Because what's
I suppose my,
right
my question was more about whether the U.S. government has taken as seriously armed right-wing white vigilante terrorism as they have taken seriously non-white groups.
We do see transition in the last few years. In the last 3, 4, 5 years, we do see more and more resources which are being diverted in order to deal with domestic groups.
Even under Trump?
Especially from the far right.
Even under Trump, do we see this?
I think it's important to distinguish between the people in the field and you know, the administration's views. From my work with law enforcement, both on the federal level and the state level, and as someone who is doing this for a long time, I definitely feel that in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there's a growing understanding of the significance of this threat and the willingness to streamline more resources to deal with threat of white supremacy groups, of militia groups, of anti-government groups. And eventually you see that also in the numbers of indictment, in the numbers of legal procedures against these groups, and in general also the desire of law enforcement agencies to work with us, with academics who study these groups, in order to gain a better understanding of their nature.
So we know for sure that even under Trump, FBI Director Christopher Wray has admitted that, albeit reluctantly it seems, that white armed vigilantes are a bigger threat or the biggest threat of violence. Let's talk about the tactics that these groups use, which you spend a lot of time in your book examining. Perhaps the most dramatic example that we can, you know, those of us who are, you know, our age can think of is the 1995 attack on the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. What are the sorts of tactics that you found these groups rely on? I mean, certainly they are ardent Second Amendment fanatics, and so it seems as though they tend to stockpile weapons. Are they preparing for a war?
Oh, definitely, especially when we're talking about the militia movement and the various militia groups. A part of their ideological framework is the belief that the federal government is a very intrusive entity that is aiming to eventually undermine their constitutional rights. And many of them believe eventually that at some point they'll need to resist that by force. This is why they are training. This is why they collect ammunition and weapons. And I won't get into all the details of their conspiracy theories, but they do believe that eventually the federal government will be taken over by foreign entities, by foreign agents, and then they'll need to fight in order to preserve what they define as the American way of life. So in their eyes, they truly believe that some kind of a significant clash is unavoidable. This is also related to the growing presence of the acceleration ideology or accelerationism, sorry for my pronunciation, the idea that eventually we'll see the eruption of a civil war, which will enable them to exploit this civil war to basically restore the traditional American way of life with the specific privileges to the white people and specific privileges to specific segments of society, and restore what they believe are the original values and practices and norms of America. So they have a very idealized perception that eventually we'll see this progression towards a grand civil war. And some of them are very clear about the fact that they engage in all these activities in order to escalate the tension, to escalate the situation in order to expedite this process that will lead us eventually to a civil war. So I do think we need to take these things seriously. Another important point that I want to emphasize is that many of these militia groups includes a significant portions of veterans of former law enforcement, which is important for two reasons. On one hand, that means that they have a lot of operational and military experience. but also because many of them are former soldiers and veterans and former law enforcement, that means that it's easier for them to mobilize support and to gain trust and to gain legitimacy. This is really the concerns with regard to these groups. If we are talking in general about the violence, we see, and I talk about that in my book, we see a dramatic increase in attacks against religious sites, as well as anti-religious, mainly anti-Islamic, Islamophobic rhetoric. So we also see some fluctuation and an overall increase in the violence against LGBTQ communities. And so we do see that there's a specific transition into specific type of targets that are becoming more and more popular among these groups.
Finally, Ari, I want to kind of touch on what you were saying earlier, which is looking at the long-term approach to dealing with this issue. I mean, you know, it can't just be about law enforcement. Also, especially given what you just said about the links between law enforcement and some of these groups, it really has to be about some sort of ideological shift. And I'm wondering if we can just end our conversation talking about the process of radicalization, certainly social media and what it thrives on. Feeds the polarization and feeds the toxic conspiracies and other things that give rise to these groups. But, you know, do you feel that the rise of the Trump presidency has awakened the racism that was already and the patriarchy that was already existing? Or does a leader like Trump successfully, effectively influence and stoke the kind of hatred that we see now, you know, and make something out of not necessarily nothing, but, you know, make something much more than we had before? That Trump's presidency has really fueled the rise of white supremacist terrorism.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think we see that on, you know, through several dimensions. For example, you know, some of the conspiracy theory that were part of the text that these groups produced 10 years ago are now much more mainstream. You know, when I listen to mainstream political officials talking today about some of these ideas, I'm thinking, wow, these are things that I was able to read 10 years ago just in the writings of the most extreme a white supremacy group. So we see really changes in the language and the rhetoric, and more conspiracy theories are becoming much more mainstream. And this is also related to the fact that the current environment provides much more legitimacy to many of these ideological tropes and ideological sentiments. If 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people were much less willing to admit that they have some positive sentiments towards these ideas, today they are much more open about that. They are much more empowered. And when you feel that your ideology have more legitimacy, whether it's more legitimacy from the political elites or from the public, you are more willing to go and engage in radical political activism, including violent activities, because you have this sense of empowerment that people are really behind you and are supportive of what you do. And that creates this kind of an environment that facilitates this kind of violence. We see a lot of racist violence, which is almost spontaneous in the sense that people are not planning it, but they are eventually involved in this kind of violent act because they really feel that it's legitimate now. It's there's popular legitimacy for it. They feel that they have this a moral imperative to engage in this kind of violence. And this is something that is really concerns, because if the discourse and the language that is used by our political leaders will continue to legitimize these kind of sentiments of hate, of racism, of xenophobia, of exclusiveness, eventually that spill over to the public, which feel more empowered to express that in its daily lives. So they'll go to the streets with their guns, they'll engage in various activities that will promote these ideas. So there's definitely a clear association between what we hear from our political leaders and what eventually we see in the streets.
Well, Ari, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Ari Perlegar. He's a professor and director of the Graduate Program in Security Studies at the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at University of Massachusetts Lowell. His many publications on political violence include Jewish Terrorism in Israel. We've been discussing his new book, American Zealots: Inside Right-Wing Domestic Terrorism. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu.